I'm Reverend Daniel Cantor. I'm senior minister at First Unitarian Church of Dallas and author of the book Faith for the Unbeliever. You're listening to the podcast Race, Violence, and Medicine.
All right, welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Dr. Brian H. Williams. Our guest is Reverend Daniel Cantor. He is the senior minister at the First Unitarian Church of Dallas. And today we're going to talk about racial equity in religion and, you know, just some topics regarding social justice and spirituality. So Reverend Cantor, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have you here. And I should say that you are a member of my church, so I'm so glad that you're here.
Now, I was going to share that, bring that to the audience later. I don't want to do a bias in any way at the very beginning, but hey, I guess we should disclose all potential conflicts of interest. So, well, tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into our topic today.
Okay, so I've been a minister in Dallas for 18 years. I came here from Boston where I served. I went to seminary in Berkeley, California. Most recently, I was a fellow at Harvard at the Divinity School there doing mostly studying and very little teaching. Involved in all kinds of things. I'm the communications chair at Faith Forward Dallas at Thanksgiving Square. I'm the chair of the Clergy Advocacy Board at Planned Parenthood Federation of America. So involved in a lot of local and national efforts.
Right. So I think you told me you had some radio experience yourself in the past, right?
I did, yeah. I spent like 8 years as a jazz DJ in Vermont. You know, we broadcast from the University of Vermont, and we broadcast to as far as Montreal and New York, and that was great. I loved it. I studied jazz. I knew the history. You know, I brought a lot of, it was fun.
Do you play also?
I play a little bit of guitar. I sing a little bit, but not much.
Well, I play drums. We got to get a
I got a band. We'll get you in there. Oh, right.
So what got you into becoming a minister? Like, tell us about that path.
Sure. There's a longer story to tell maybe than here. I had a call moment in a mountaintop in the Himalayas, which is, you know, like something right out of the Bible. The call was, I heard in my head, I was on my way to becoming a Buddhist monk, actually. And I heard the words during a meditation, return home and serve your people. So I listened. I didn't exactly go right away. A little Jonah in there.
Right.
But I spent, I returned home. My people were Unitarian Universalists. I started getting involved in the church in Burlington, Vermont. I was teaching. I was teaching extremely behaviorally, emotionally disturbed teenagers. Mostly guys who were in and out of jail, who were really struggling in lots of different ways. We were two teachers and six kids in a special program in the Burlington school system. And I started thinking about my life and my pursuit of religious wisdom. I had been studying different religions all my life, really. And I had grown up a Unitarian Universalist, so I was given the permission to really explore as part of our faith. It's the idea that no one has a monopoly on the truth, including us, so that we have to really tests all these things out in the world freely. So in returning to the country, I started to kind of weave together this interest in religion and then the other side of the call, serve your people, and realized that I could do that effectively through the ministry. And so I ended up going to Berkeley, California, one of our seminaries, and studying and loving it and getting involved as a minister in St. Louis, and then Boston, and then coming to Dallas.
Well, Boston is near and dear to my heart. That's where I did my residency. I was up there for 7 years, and I met my wife there, and I first learned about Unitarian Universalism there. Is that the original churches in Boston?
A lot of original churches are there, yeah.
Right, I guess, yeah. So that's where I first learned about that, and my wife, you know, she was going to the church there, and still a point in my life where I was still anti-religion and anti-church. It took me coming to Dallas before I actually stepped back into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I talked about this. My reticence was all about the lack of black representation in the religion that I was taught growing up, all the white male imagery and the idolatry. And it, I just didn't feel like I fit into that story. But what attracted me to this was this concept of radical inclusivity.
Yes.
And tell us about that and then the work you're doing in the church to make it more racially inclusive.
Yeah. So, I mean, theologically, the radically inclusive comes from our universalist background, which said that God would save all, that God loved all creation and in the end would save all. And so that we had to treat every human being with the eyes of God. And so if we try to live up to that, and the Unitarians who saw Jesus as more prophet, more teacher, if we tried to live up to his example, then him sitting with everyone was, you know, these are metaphors for going beyond the boundaries of our own bias, our own reality, our own self-images, and really trying to see the divine in each person. So that's the theological basis. Now, the history in this church, particular in Dallas, is that we've tried to live up to that politically in different ways. This church was integrated in 1945 by the act of the board. That was way before anybody in Texas was talking about. We might have been the first church in the state to officially integrate. I think
so. You said 45. That's 20 years before the Civil Rights Act.
Okay. Yes, yes. I think it was the influence of World War II. I think people were coming back and they had had experiences that were integrated in the armed services. And they were saying, well, why wouldn't our church live up to just that, right? In the 50s, Robert Rabel, who was the senior minister here, worked to desegregate the schools. We have sermons from 1957 and Brown versus Board of Education. I've read those sermons in the archives at Harvard. And he was staunch advocate for the integration of the schools. Of course, in Dallas, didn't happen until the 70s. So he never actually saw that realized here until he had retired. Those are some of the examples of where we start. Civil rights, Unitarian ministers were at Selma, they were involved with King, they were involved in all kinds of civil rights action. One of our ministers, James Reeb, was killed at Selma by a white mob. He was a white minister. We had other lay people who were shot because they were helping people get back and forth to the march. So we've been involved in these issues. We still have a lot of work to do. So, you know, you can be involved in those kinds of efforts to make things more equal, remove signs that say colored and white in your, you know, in your community, but not actually make structural changes. And I think that's where we're headed now. Now, in Unitarian Universalism, we're starting to ask the question, you know, what structurally or how are our whole systems biased by white culture? And that's an exciting movement. It's a movement that is challenging. It's difficult. And it's difficult for us, especially white people, to see where we live comfortably in those structures. So racial equity work at this church right now has really, we've done some things. We've had what we call Journey Toward Wholeness, where we tried to engage this. We've done all kinds of efforts. Now today we've got a racial equity team. They're really looking at, you know, how do we engage everyone in the church in conversations about their own biases? How do we also nourish people spiritually so that it doesn't just traumatize people, either people of color or white people? And that's the real challenge, is because a lot of this conversation has to come from the heart, and it also has to open up doors to healing and transformation rather than just guilt and shame, which is really the challenge I see in a lot of the racial equity work all over the world, really, is that if it's only a white person's problem, that, you know, then, and it ignores it, actually, a lot of white people have been traumatized by this and comfortable in the structure, then we're missing something.
Right. So I want to pick up that thread after we take a break here. So I'll just say, the church definitely walks the walk when it comes to these issues of social justice and racial equity. But I still see myself as a, you know, anomaly, or not anomaly, a minority, racially, but also in the numbers that I see when I come to worship. But I want to pick up on that thread as we take a break and continue with that discussion. So thanks for tuning in. This is Race, Violence, and Medicine. Our guest is Reverend Daniel Cantor. He's a senior minister at the First Unitarian Church in Dallas. You can follow this show at brianwilliamsmd.com. That's Brian with an I. We will be back after a short break. Stick with us. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. Our guest today is Reverend Daniel Cantor. He is the senior minister at the First Unitarian Church in Dallas, Texas. We are talking about some of the work he and his church are doing in terms of racial equity, as well as a history of race within the church. So, Reverend Cantor, before the break, you were talking about the work that's really about the history of the church, the first to integrate in 1945, and the work they were done as far as desegregating schools back in the 50s. So they began this work long before the Civil Rights Act, a Civil Rights movement came to a head in the 60s. But continuing through today, I feel comfortable with the church as far as its philosophy and putting words and deeds to action in regards to social justice and racial equity. But I still look around and I see myself as, you know, a minority when it comes to racial minority within the church. So how do you grapple with that in the work that we're doing now to bring awareness about racial equity?
Yeah, not to dodge that, but also just as you're talking about, I'll get back to it. One thing I thought about also is, you know, I mean, we're not perfect, but the history also includes a lot of work on abolition. Originally, we were probably the first denomination to ordain a woman in the 1800s. I mean, like, so we've been on the edge of a lot of these issues. Right.
And that's what I really like about the church, because all these things that matter to me when it comes to human rights and, you know, gender equity and sexual orientation, like anything you can think of when you talk about marginalized folks, the church is like, no, we want you to be a part of us. We will stand with you and stand up for you.
Yeah.
So that's what, that's why I became comfortable coming back to church, because of that philosophy.
Yeah. And we've probably done really well on, you know, on things like LGBT rights, which started 40, 50 years ago, and now fully integrate that. Now, you know, like, I know you look around, I actually see the most most diverse congregation that we've had, in history. I see a lot of children of color, especially. I actually do see a lot of people of color, multi-ethnic, multiracial families. So I'm starting to see that change. I think part of it is because people don't know we're here. If we were in Boston, everybody would know who we were because of the history, you know. So it takes a lot. But also, just to be honest, we have a barrier. We are smack in the middle of the University Park. I've been publicly and openly critical of University Park's policies where, you know, they have police on the edges of the city, and if you don't look like you belong here, they find reasons to pull you over. So I've talked to people who call friends of mine who say, I'm not sure I want to go to the church because where it is. Now, when you get here, you transcend those problems.
Well, I'll tell you, I drive through here on my way to work every day, and I may go 1 mile over the speed limit, maybe two. So I'm very cognizant that I am out of place when I'm just driving through here on a daily basis to work.
Yeah. I mean, I got pulled over for driving a Toyota Camry or Corolla with a dent in the back of the car. So, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm not the image of...
You better get yourself a Lexus.
Yeah, right. So I think there are some boundaries there. They're real, you know. It's North Dallas, South Dallas. It's, you know, there's a lot of segregation. I mean, we could probably count on two hands the number of people of color live in University Park. So we're up against that. The fact that we are as diverse and inclusive as we are, I think, is the celebration.
And I will say over the past 8 years, I've seen the increase, just anecdotally from when I look around. So I agree with you totally when I see that there's definitely an increase.
But also people, you know, when people of color come here, they've got to, you know, they also have to understand the effort, you know. Right. I mean, if you walk in and you say, oh, another white church, you know, and they don't hear the commitment, or they don't see the commitment, that's an easy one to walk away from.
Right.
So, and sometimes it takes, you know, a couple times to be here, you know.
Right.
So, you know, and then if I think with a racial equity lens, I also think, you know, there's classically white music to some extent. There's, I don't know, you know, if these are really barriers, because people of color or all kinds of people tell me the music's wonderful. But it's something for us to think about. Just the structure of our service is very Protestant in a way, even though we'd be radical Reformation, you know, side of all the Protestantism. Theologically, we're, you know, very progressive. The format looks and feels more Protestant, so that there are built-in barriers that I think connect in the head. But in the heart, I think, like you're saying, if you meet people and you get involved and you listen a little deeply with the heart mind, you can transcend those boundaries.
So let's talk about some of the other work in, I'm just going to call the social justice landscape space that the church does. Your work with the Poor People's Campaign. Can you tell us, you know, for someone that doesn't know what that is, because that has a long history in this country,
yeah,
what that campaign is about and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little disappointed with, and I hate to say it, but Texas's Poor People's Campaign has not lived up to what I hoped. And partly that might be my fault, but I'm not in charge of it. Poor People's Campaign comes out of King's, you know, focus on poverty. He was not only, everybody points to King and says it was all about, you know, civil rights, you know, for, you know, getting black communities more integrated and all that. But his message, as many know, was also about militarism. It was a large part about poverty. So the Poor People's Campaign led to, you know, the strikes of the garbage workers in Montgomery and whatnot. And so William Barber, Reverend Barber's recreated the Poor People's Campaign to stand up for areas in our society where people who are poor, where poverty lives, and where they're being erased. So I've done some work, not enough. I mean, I admit I've got a lot of other things going on, but we went to the state capitol and we were trying to, you know, protest there for workers' rights and other issues, and not getting either a lot of attention or a lot of following, which I don't know exactly what it means. Like, you know, are people in Texas not interested in poverty issues? I can't put my finger on it,
right.
But we couldn't really get a lot of momentum with Poor People's Campaign. It's ongoing. I haven't seen a lot of action recently. Other local efforts include Confederate monument issues through Thanksgiving Square, where I'm involved with a lot of racial equity, police board things. I'm not personally involved in that much, but that's the, you know, that's where some of these efforts are really coming to bear for me in my participation in local efforts.
Right. So you mentioned Thanksgiving Square a couple of times, and, you know, I just let you know, I'm talking to some other faith leaders in Dallas as well.
Yeah.
That I'm sure they're your contemporaries. You probably know them through Thanksgiving Square.
Yes.
Tell us what that's about.
Yeah. So we were preparing a group of clergy, black and white clergy, north and south, were preparing for the eventuality of a shooting or an act of violence in our city. There had been school shootings and all kinds of things going on all around the country. And we were almost literally, you know, sitting in Thanksgiving Square trying to figure out what we needed to do to organize when the shooting downtown happened that you were involved in as a medical professional. And immediately we said, call the mayor's office. We've got the group that's organized. It has the memorial service or the sort of protest service has to be at Thanksgiving Square, and we're going to be involved. So we sort of took over that space, and the mayor's office showed up and said, yeah, okay, that's good planning. We're going to follow you. And that was really the birth of Faith Forward Dallas. And I remember sitting in the hall underneath talking with one of the rabbis, Rabbi Paley, who's a friend of mine. And he had to preach that night. The shooting was, I think, on a Thursday or Wednesday night.
It was Thursday night.
Thursday night. And it was Friday. We were at Thanksgiving. And he had to preach that night. I had to preach Sunday. And we were just sitting there saying to each other, what do you say? You know, what do you say? And then we walked out, and I don't know, it must have been, you know, 1,000 people were in Thanksgiving Square trying to create some solidarity for the city around what had happened.
So I guess we should probably put some context for someone that may not know. There was a shooting July 7th, 2016 here in Dallas where 12 police officers were shot by a sniper. And Reverend Cantor was referring to the efforts afterwards to bring some solidarity within the city. And I didn't realize Faith Forward and Thanksgiving Square came out of that. I thought they existed prior to that.
Well, we did and we didn't. I mean, we were kind of floundering trying to figure out how we were going to respond because we knew something was going to come.
Right.
And you could see it. Things like this were happening all over the country. We didn't know what exactly. But we knew we needed each other and we knew the city needed us. And so when faith voices come together, a different kind of context is put on these events. They're not just news events. They're human events. They're events that require a moral and spiritual lens that translates them. And so we knew we were going to be needed. We just didn't know what. And then that event happened and it was born. For many years, I was involved with Thanksgiving Square's Interfaith Council, which was largely just a, not just, but it was an effort to get to know each other and so that, you know, we wouldn't be isolated in our you know, right. silos, religious silos. But this effort, Faith Forward, really was shaped by that moment. And then further, you know, down the road, we've sort of organized around these different issues of racial equity and immigration and poverty and homelessness. So now we're laser focused on those things, gun violence, and
I love it. Those are all things that get me excited and motivated to get out of bed and do the work I do every day. So let's take one last break. This is Race, Violence, and Medicine. Our guest is Reverend Daniel Cantor, senior minister at the First Unitarian Church in Dallas. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to find out what is next for Reverend Cantor. Thank you. Don't go away. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I'm Dr. Brian H. Williams, sitting here with Reverend Daniel Cantor from the First Unitarian Church in Dallas. We've been having a fascinating discussion about social justice and spirituality and the journey he's taken to get where he is today. But now we want to find out what's going to happen for you next, Reverend Cantor.
Is that just an open-ended question? Yes,
open-ended question, and if you slip up somewhere, I'll jump on that, and we'll keep going.
That's right. Well, it's a lot of continuation of the work. So we're trying to figure out, at Thanksgiving Square, we're trying to figure out good ways to communicate what we're doing, you know, highlighting a lot of really great efforts by clergy all over the country, all over the county, really in Dallas County, and even beyond. And I'm continuing my work with Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Now, I know this is going to get controversial for some people. Everybody thinks Planned Parenthood, all they do is abortions, which is, you know, far from the truth. They're, you know, it's 2-3% of the total service.
And as a doctor, I can tell you, like, they provide much needed services for women that don't have access anywhere.
And especially poor women, especially brown and black women.
Right.
And so my advocacy work at the national level continues. We've been coalescing faith voices because we have basically ceded that whole topic to conservative evangelicals over the last 40 years. It was a deliberate strategy and I've studied the history by conservative evangelicals to take over this issue, but largely to take over political power using the abortion issue. So we get all these fights about defund Planned Parenthood. This is 40 years in the making. Supreme Court justices, whatever, because, and I'll tell you the history. There was a court case with Bob Jones University during the Carter administration where they lost because it was about, they wanted to continue segregation between black and white students who were dating. They weren't allowing dating, and it became a federal court case. It went to the Supreme Court, and they lost the case. There's a famous phone call that followed that case of people like Jerry Falwell and others. And they said, they were like, well, we can't let this kind of thing happen. How do we take political power? The answer, somebody on the line said, what about abortion? 40 years later, this is documented, 40 years later, we've got, you know, these efforts in the White House and Supreme Court. I mean, you know, and I'm showing some of my political bias, but you know what they're trying to do, having used that issue all the way, is now defund an organization that largely serves poor women to do healthcare. So keeping their bodies cancer free and you know, understanding their reproductive systems and controlling their ability to have or not have children, making decisions between their doctors and their clergy and their families. And it's a real, that's an intersection of race, violence, and healthcare.
Right.
That, you know, really we could go down that road. You know, when you get these religious freedom, kind of quote unquote religious freedom agendas that are about restricting women's freedoms.
Right.
That's what really bothers me. And so, you know, as the chair of the advocacy board at Planned Parenthood, I'm trying to gather as many progressive clergy to not only voice opinions about this, but also to be ready if we get to a post-Roe world, which, you know, everyone's pretty sure that's going to happen, although it's probably a chipping away of Roe v. Wade more than just a complete outlaw of it. You know, clergy in this congregation and clergy all over Dallas and clergy in other cities before Roe used to counsel women about abortion and get them to safe and legal abortions in the Gulf of Mexico. They used to drive people to put them on boats. So what's the, you know, in a post-Roe world, you know, what are we talking about? We're talking about hundreds and hundreds, millions of children who are going to be impacted by unwanted families, you know, all kinds of, I mean, they, you know, if we extrapolate this out, it's a huge public health crisis that is being ideologically driven. And so I'm trying to help shore up those response efforts and take back some of the sort of dialectic around this issue at the national
level. And what I find fascinating about all that is when religion and spirituality is presented as this means of you know, service and inclusivity, but it's used as an instrument to advance political and a political agenda that will harm certain people. I can't reconcile that in my mind, those two. Which I see it, I understand it conceptually, but personally I'm like, why would you want to diminish the worth and diminish the value of what it means to be a spiritual person or a religious person in order to further political ends to harm someone else?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to think about is, you know, people go back, you know, I've heard people say to me, well, religion shouldn't be involved in politics. The fact is that religion's been involved in politics since the founding of our country. That's not even an issue. It's the issue of how do you put your values into political agendas. So political dialogue is actually very important. And actually, the evangelicals are right around this time we're having this debate. Billy Graham was saying, you know, we shouldn't be advocating political agendas. We should be spreading, you know, the word of Christianity. And others are saying, well, we're not going to get anywhere if we don't take on these political agendas. Now, they chose, and some continue to choose, divisive wedges, political wedges in our society. Now, you know, does a congregation that promotes anti-gay and lesbian agendas, are they doing it intentionally because they want to spread hatred? No. I mean, they're doing it because somehow that social issue became central to who they are, even though if we really dig deeply into the scripture, we're not going to find, you know, a lot about that. So, you know, others are saying, well, if we want power and money, we're going to have to go through politics. So, I think power also makes change. So there's a real balancing point there, right? Because is it for good or for harm? And that's in the eye of the beholder, but it's also in the eyes of the community at large. So do clergy go into the border to you know, confront this issue of a border wall and all that? Is that for good or ill? It depends on what side of that proverbial wall you stand on, right?
Yeah. Right. What they're saying, if you want to test a person's integrity, give them power.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Right.
So, oh man, I was going to ask you a question and it just slipped my mind, Reverend Cantor. Anyway, you're going to be going to India soon, taking a pilgrimage there. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, we've got Unitarians in India who've been there 130 years. Quick, fun story about that is that somebody 130 years ago, a man named Kisor Singh founded a religion on his own, and like a year into it, he had 5 or 10 people, and somebody said, "Well, that's Unitarianism."
Right.
So he connected with Unitarians. Now there's 10,000 over there. So, you know, he grew this beautiful tree, and we're trying to just connect. Our church is trying to connect with them. Yeah.
So I like what you said. You said you need to do a daily practice, weekly worship, an annual conference.
Monthly service, annual retreat,
and a pilgrimage once in a lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, that's a model that we use here that we try to live by.
Well, I still have to work on that pilgrimage, but I'm just now getting back into my religious practice. Yeah. So I think I have some time to get my house in order. Yeah. Well, Reverend Cantor, thank you very much for this fascinating conversation. If any of our listeners want to contact you after the show, how can they do that?
So I'm on Twitter at RevDCCantor. You can find me through my book, Faith for the Unbeliever.
Oh, that's right, the book, man. Come on.
Yeah. It's Faith for the Unbelievers.
I can't believe I forgot about
that's
that.
That's all right.
Thank you. All right. Yeah. Say it slowly.
Yeah.
The book,
Faith for the Unbeliever.
Okay.
It's a challenge to the notion that faith is only about belief, but it's also a book that asks you through story what's important to you. So you can find that, and you can find me through those channels. Facebook, etc. Our website at the church is dallasuu.org, and that's a good way to find out what's happening here and be in touch with me.
And that's Cantor with a K, so DC Cantor, K-N-T-E-R.
T-E-R, yeah.
I cannot believe I forgot to bring up the book, Reverend.
That's all right. It's only been out a year and a half.
You got me all
psyched.
I'm all here. Let's talk about racism. Let's tackle that. All right. Well, thank you all for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Brian H. Williams. This is Race, Violence, and Medicine. Again, my website is brianwilliamsmd.com. That's Brian with an I. You can sign up for the newsletter there. And this podcast, please share with your family and friends. It's available anywhere you listen to podcasts. My main platform is Anchor FM. But again, it is available anywhere. And always, I want to make a show that is worth your time every single episode. So send me your comments, suggestions, critique. The best way to get me is at Twitter at BHWilliamsMD. That concludes our show for today. Thank you for tuning in.